This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. The maritime transportation industry is a vital industry, contributing more than $1 billion a year to the national economy. It is also an industry that has evolved in a highly sophisticated global intermodal transportation network. Thousands of vessels ply the world's vast ocean highways and America's waterways, carrying huge quantities of consumer goods and other cargo. What are the key challenges facing the maritime transportation system in the 21st century? How is the Maritime Administration working to enhance the competitiveness of U.S. transportation providers and manufacturers? And what is the U.S. Maritime Administration doing to modernize its business processes and use resources more efficiently? We'll explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, David Matsuda, Administrator of the Maritime Administration within the U.S. Department of Transportation. Welcome, David. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
Before we delve into specific initiatives, perhaps you could provide us with an overview of the history and evolution of the Maritime Administration. When was it created and what's its mission today?
Well, this is an agency that dates back a very long time, back to the mid-1930s. In fact, Joseph P. Kennedy was one of the very first maritime administrators. So I am honored to hold a role that he once did. I can tell you that it has evolved over the years. The agency at one point split into two. One of them is the Federal Maritime Commission, which is the independent board, and us, the Maritime Administration. Maritime Administration used to be in the Department of Commerce, and in the early 1980s was transferred over to the Department of Transportation, where we've been ever since.
Operationally, how is your agency organized? What's the size of its budget and number of employees? And more particularly, how does it interact with the other modes within the Department of Transportation?
Well, that's a very good question, because since the Coast Guard left and became part of the Department of Homeland Security, the Maritime Administration is really the primary maritime agency now in the department. And unlike many of our agency partners, we don't regulate. We're more of a promotional agency. Okay. So while the department's chief mission is safety, we do maintain a strong promotional advocacy role for the maritime industry. We've got about 830 employees, a budget of about $300 to $400 million of appropriated funds. But frankly, we do a lot of services for other federal agencies and manage about $1 billion total.
And geographically, how are you organized geographically?
We've got a headquarters office here at the Department of Transportation headquarters, about 250 employees. The Merchant Marine Academy, which we oversee, about 250 employees up there in Kings Point, New York, out on Long Island. And the remainder of the field offices are spread throughout the continental U.S.
So with a rich history and an important mission, I'd like to know a little bit more about what you do as the administrator. Could you tell us a little bit more about your specific responsibilities and duties? And how are your efforts supporting the overall mission of the Department of Transportation?
Absolutely. Well, as administrator, the buck stops with me. And I'm responsible for the functioning of the agency, the overall operation, and as the chief advisor to the Secretary of Transportation on maritime issues and activities, I take that role very seriously. As I mentioned earlier, we have a unique role in that we're primarily an advocacy or promotional agency. So we don't do, you know, the type of safety regulation and oversight that the other agencies do in the department. But I know the Department of Transportation has a strong initiative and is one of their strategic goals to promote the economic competitiveness of the United States. And that is something that is our primary role as well when we deal with the United States maritime industry. We want to promote it. We want to promote jobs, U.S. businesses, economic opportunities for both workers and businesses in this key industry.
Well, excellent. Regarding your responsibilities and duties, what are the three top challenges you face in that position, and how are you addressing these challenges?
Well, probably the top challenge has been trying to deal with the demons of the past for this agency and refocusing on the challenges of the future, the things we really need to be looking at. I'll say that one of the first things I dealt with when I first came to the agency was an ongoing and contentious lawsuit with a local community in the San Francisco Bay Area. Local regulators out there, a number of environmental groups had sued and blocked the agency from carrying out its ship disposal program because of concern about the way the ships were maintained. We spent a lot of time and effort settling the lawsuit, and it's been a very successful settlement. We've been able to move forward with the program. We have recycled about 25 ships out of the facility. These were old, World War II era vessels that we needed to move out, help clean up the bay environment, and help create jobs and put people to work in the U.S. Recycling industry as well. But that was probably one of the chief challenges. The other one that we've dealt with is the United States Merchant Marine Academy at Kings Point. And when we came on board, we had to face a number of congressional investigation findings that the operations of the school were not lawful, that there have been a number of violations of the Anti-Deficiency Act, which I think most federal employees kind of hear and may shudder when they hear that, because it is one of the crimes, I guess, of the federal budget world. But we have taken a very strong and intense effort to make sure that the financial control and internal controls are in place to be able to give Congress and others the credibility and confidence that we can handle funds appropriately. And in fact, the school so badly needs them. So it really was a top priority. And again, fixing some of these problems of the past has allowed us to really focus on challenges going forward.
What about your career path? Could you tell our listeners a little about yourself and how you got to where you are now?
Absolutely. I came to Washington shortly after law school from the West Coast in San Diego. And I gave up the sunny environs to learn a little bit more about how Washington works. And I haven't looked back. I started as a staff lawyer in a small agency called the Federal Railroad Administration. And I've long enjoyed working in the transportation field and industry. So this was a great opportunity. After a number of years, I had the opportunity to do a detail with the United States Senate on one of the transportation committees. This was the Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee. Again, a wonderful experience. I really enjoyed working in the Congress and ended up staying another 6 years after that working for a senator from New Jersey, Senator Frank Lautenberg. And I handled transportation issues, or advised him on transportation issues. And I think many might recognize that he is someone who has been very involved in transportation for a very long time. So it gave me a great exposure to the many different types of industries and issues, and just really kept me interested. And it really opened up a lot more opportunities and things for me to learn and grow. And when the President Obama was elected, I had the opportunity to join his administration. And again, I have been honored to serve. And I continue to enjoy it and to learn and grow, and just thankful for the people that are on my team and that I work with every day, not just the ones, the other political appointees, but certainly all of the career staff who I've long known are some of the best in the business.
So can I ask a question regarding your team, and how do you lead them? What are some of the characteristics you have that kind of mark or define an effective leader?
Well, when you talk about an internal team, I think the key is to make sure that you have folks that are that you have confidence and trust in, and then you can empower them to take on responsibilities, to exercise discretion and judgment. And I think that's the key. That's how I endeavor to run our organization. As far as the senior leadership goes, the career staff within the agency, these are professionals. They're managers. They don't need, you know, micromanagement. What they do need is direction. And we try to provide that as best we can. I know that, you know, I'm often looking at opportunities where I'll say that career staff haven't always enjoyed the type of attention from the political leadership as they have in this administration. So I know that many times I've seen the appreciation for the time and attention spent on the various issues that they're working on.
What are the challenges facing the maritime transportation system in the 21st century? We will ask David Matsuda, Administrator of the U.S. Maritime Administration, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What are the 7 management imperatives all government executives need to know? How is DoD improving its business operations? What is FAA's Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextJet? How is New York City shaping a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And what about power, security, and leadership in the 21st century? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is David Matsuda, Administrator of the U.S. Maritime Administration. Dave, many may be loosely familiar with the maritime transportation system, so could you perhaps describe it for us? What are the critical elements and nodes that make up this global system, and what are some of the key challenges facing this system in the 21st century?
Well, the maritime industry is so unique. It's been around for hundreds of years, probably thousands. But what's so unique about it is that with the storied past that it's had, it's played such an important role in the development of our nation. But what many people don't realize is that it continues to play such a key role today. If you look at over 95% of everything imported into this country arrives by ship, it kind of tells you that it's still a key part of our economy, our national defense, to keeping us safe at home. It's critical. If you talk to, and I work very closely with a number of our Department of Defense, our military commanders, and they talk about what is needed for their supply chains. How do you get supplies, bullets, ammunition to the troops on the front lines? It's got to come by maritime. If you're going to keep sustain a war effort, or maybe if it's bringing relief supplies for humanitarian causes after an earthquake, say like the one we had in Haiti last year. And we actually watched as this happened, but as the number of flights that could come in bringing relief supplies was so limited on the small airport serving Port-au-Prince, you really had to get the port open to bring in ships to carry the real significant number of supplies needed. I think that was a very, say, colorful experience where it showed exactly how important maritime was. I think when we did the math, we figured out that a single ship could bring as many as about 400 times the number of supplies that a single C-17 flight could deliver into Haiti. And when you have a million people in need, that was that's something that you've got to take into account. Just the simple math and logistics is what really drives this industry in terms of what keeps it going, why it's still important today. I can tell you, as a promotional agency, our biggest challenge is getting people to understand how important it still is today. It keeps our country's economy flowing. Again, the military aspect, the humanitarian aspect, there are jobs in this industry, whether it's people serving on a ship or in the front office or in a shipbuilding facility, a shipyard, or they're repairing vessels, or they're training new ship's officers. It's a very exciting industry, very dynamic, and I don't think a lot of people realize that. That's actually one of our biggest challenges.
Early in this decade, the Maritime Administration leadership recognized the need to address landside congestion through expanded use of water-borne transportation alternatives. To that end, would you elaborate on America's Marine Highways Initiative, highlighting the core components of this initiative and its intended benefit?
Absolutely. Well, let me just start by saying that I think that while that may be true, this administration has taken a slightly different focus for the program. In fact, the singular focus on highway congestion has somewhat evolved now that the Obama administration is really looking at things from a twofold perspective. Number one, the livability of a community or transportation system. I don't think that our efforts are entirely targeted toward highways. How do we relieve congestion on the highways? But rather a broader approach to say, well, if you're living in a commuter, how do we actually make it more livable for you? You know, why don't we, for instance, take a look at siting, housing opportunities closer to where people work so that you don't have a long commute, or give you other options to get to work, like taking transit or biking or walking. So it's a much more comprehensive approach to not just focusing on congestion, but frankly, how people live. The second element that we've really focused on is sustainability. If we are moving things, and things must move in order to keep our economy going, freight, passengers, wherever people or goods are moving to, how can we make this entire system more sustainable? Mm-hmm. And I think the environmental sustainability question is one that will continue to pose a challenge. I think that the maritime industry, for one, is one where there's great promise to move more goods on the water. And that's where we see the America's Marine Highway Program really fitting into this overall strategy. Yes, it can help relieve highway congestion, but it does so many more things, too, that we need to focus on. It can create jobs, mm-hmm. not just for people working on the ships, the mariners themselves, but also in shipyards. If we're building new ships to go out there and offer service to carry goods along the waterways instead of on the congested highways, it can also help with, like I mentioned, livability. Safety is certainly an issue. We've seen the potential for hazardous material spills and incidents and what that can do to the highway. And those kinds of disruptions, I think, pose a real risk to our economy. And there are certainly, if we really put our heads together and think about how can we move certainly dangerous chemicals, but just even regular goods as well, more efficiently on the water without having to take those kinds of risks.
Well, actually, I'd like to explore a point that you raised in your earlier anecdote around Haiti and the emergency response. Your administration plays an integral role in the country's defense as a mission support apparatus and also in emergency response preparedness. What role does the Maritime Security Program play in this area? And could you tell us a little bit more about this program?
Sure. Well, the Maritime Security Program is a way to make sure that there are commercial merchant ships available to the United States government whenever we need them. And that way that we don't have to have government ships that are funded by the taxpayer where they're not needed all the time. We may be using these ships once a decade, but we need to have that readiness and that capability. So this program effectively accomplishes that by making sure that these ships will be available by paying the private operators a small retainer fee to make sure that they will operate under the United States flag. They will maintain United States citizen mariner jobs for the use of the military when called upon. Believe me, it's a much cheaper way to do it than growing the Navy or growing even a commercial government merchant service. I guess in a sense, it's one of the original public-private partnerships, the United States Merchant Marine. And the Maritime Security Program is one of the key ways in which we can make sure that that sea lift capability is there when the nation needs it.
Now, are you doing anything to enhance its effectiveness currently?
Absolutely. We are taking a close look at the program to understand what we need to do going forward. We're working with our partners in the industry, partners in the military, and certainly on Capitol Hill as the Congress looks at extending the program for another 10 years or so. These types of incentives are needed to make sure that there will be a U.S. merchant marine going forward. It is very tough to compete in the world market given the costs that American flag operators face. And so anything we can do to provide that incentive and in exchange get that guarantee that they'll be ready when we need them is critically important.
Well, I'd like to talk about how you do that in your agency. And one of the ways you do that is the Title 11, the Maritime Guaranteed Loan Program. Could you tell us a little bit more about the purpose and intent of this program? And what are some of the challenges you're facing with this program in an era of fiscal constraints?
Well, that's a good question. This is a program that goes back quite a ways. There used to be construction subsidies. There used to be loans. It's evolved into a loan guarantee, which really leverages the federal dollar because you're not paying out the full amount of every loan every time, but only a credit risk premium so that a small amount of money can finance a larger number of shipbuilding projects. In previous administrations, we've seen this program go through some interesting evolutions. I think the Inspector General had done a thorough job of pointing out some of the risks in the program and finding ways to help strengthen the analysis of the review and the application process before these loan guarantees are granted. There were a large number of high-profile defaults in the program before I got here. So I inherited quite a fleet, I guess, as we paid off. The agency had paid off some of these loans and taken possession of the ships that were built. So we've got the Title 11 fleet, and we're continuing to do the best we can to sell off the assets, pay back the federal government accounts, and make sure that, you know, we're putting these ships back into service and creating jobs and not just having them sit around in a federal fleet somewhere. The challenge going forward is trying to find the right balance between strong the review of a new application and making sure that it's continuing to be a tool that's useful to the commercial shipbuilders and their customers. Because if it's not useful and it's not working, nobody's going to use it. I've heard complaints about the timing it takes for a review. You know, what's shocking to me is most people don't understand that a lot of the cause for the delay is that an applicant will come in, say they want help, they want a loan guarantee, but then when we ask them for more information, that there's typically long periods of delay, and then when it gets toward the two-year deadline, things start moving again, and then there's a lot of pressure to get things done. One of the changes we're making is to say, look, we're not going to waste our time with people who just want to get in and let the clock start ticking. But if they're not actually working on their application, we're not just sticking it on the bottom of the stack. We'll kick it out and say, you know, you need to either pay attention, keep this moving, or you're just not ready.
Well, actually, I was wondering, what does your agency do in terms of support and assistance for small shipyards?
We have a wonderful program. It's a grant program where we provide grants to small shipyards. It's sometimes seen as a misnomer because some of these shipyards may be, the facility itself may be small, mm-hmm. but the owner may be a large multinational corporation. So you see a name on it of a big defense contractor, and you say, why are you giving them a grant? They're not small by any means. No, but the facility is. And the work they do at that facility, the capabilities that go on at these facilities are critical because they're the ones who are providing mostly the repair services for U.S. Flagships, and we need to make sure that we keep that critical capacity there as well.
That's great. And you had mentioned earlier as one of your core challenges and one of your core priorities is addressing and heightening the profile, if you will, and prestige of the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy out on Long Island. I'd like to know more about the mission of this academy and what are some of the issues it's facing and how are you addressing some of these issues?
The academy has long gone by the United Merchant Marine Academy at Kings Point, and some people refer to it as just Kings Point in the industry. There's a number of maritime academies, but there's only one that's our national maritime academy. And the key role and mission is to graduate future maritime leaders for the industry. its focus is working to develop not just mariner skills, not just engineering skills, the academic, but they want to, like the other academies, are focusing on developing the complete person. A strong focus, again, not just on academics, not just on ship handling, but on leadership. And we've seen over time that, you know, these are folks, many of them go on to be leaders in the industry. They work their way up, you know, after sailing for some time and taking that experience and really leveraging it and just going on to do great things. I'll point out that astronaut Mark Kelly was a Merchant Marine Academy graduate. Maybe one example of many that folks who've just gone on to do great things and not always recognized for it. That's been one of the big challenges. And I know when Secretary LaHood, and he obviously started before I did, but when he first went to Kings Point, he was so impressed with the people and the midshipmen and the potential that he said, you know, this has really got to be the kind of a jewel of an academy that, you know, the other schools are. You hear about the Navy Academy, Naval Academy, West Point, and the Air Force Academy. We really need the kind of attention and support that these other academies get. And they have it in this administration, that's for sure. We've seen unprecedented levels of interest, budgeting, you know, support just for everything the academy does. If you look at the numbers, there's so many more federal dollars spent on the other academies than on Kings Point. And it's just amazing because you get, you know, the product you get out of it is just so fantastic that there really does need to be a better model of investment for the school.
You mentioned one of the challenges. What are some of the other challenges that it's facing in terms of outside the business operation areas?
Probably the three key areas were internal and financial controls, as I mentioned. Second is the campus and facilities. Okay. It was built in the 1940s, and many of the old buildings are still there, and they have not been updated. It's led to, you know, I think as with any older facility you deal with, you know, higher maintenance costs, energy costs. You know, you don't have the efficiencies of the modern-day construction. We also, it was the first academy to admit women. But the problem is there weren't changes made to the campus to be able to accommodate them properly. So, you know, nobody redesigned, you know, a facility to have both a men's room and a ladies' room, a restroom, and or a ladies' locker room. And so some of these things really need to be done more effectively. I've been to the campus and seen things like converted, you know, storage closets that are now, you know, a female locker room or restroom facilities. And that's just not what we want for the school, and it's certainly just not appropriate.
Well, I'd like to continue on this line and talk about the State Maritime Academy program. How does it complement the mission of the Merchant Marine Academy at Kings Point? And what are some of the ways it significantly increases the recruitment of future maritime?
The State Maritime Academies are fantastic. I've been to a number of them and seen just the strong programs they have in maritime. I will say that while the maritime, while the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy focuses on licensed officers, not every state academy has such a singular focus. Many of them actually have the flexibility to adapt to trends in the U.S. industry a little better and say, for instance, if there is a strong need for graduates with education experience that will help out in, say, shipyard finance or a related maritime industry that's not necessarily working as a ship's officer, these other schools can help fill that need. And so they really specialize in a number of areas and a number of ways. They all have proud traditions as well and fantastic graduates and alumni, very supportive. In fact, we hire at the Maritime Administration, I know we have people from every single maritime academy in the country, whether state or the U.S. Marine Academy.
How is the Maritime Administration working to enhance the competitiveness of the United States? We will ask David Matsuda, Administrator of the U.S. Maritime Administration, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is FAA's Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen? How is the U.S. Department of Homeland Security turning its one DHS vision into reality? What is New York City doing to shape a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And how is the DoD improving its business operations? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Hear from FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, DHS Undersecretary for Management Raphael Boris, New York City Deputy Mayor for Operations Stephen Goldsmith, and Dave Winogren, Assistant Deputy Chief Management Officer at DoD. Professor Joseph Nye and General Anthony Zinni on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century, and seven management imperatives that government leaders should pursue to be successful in an era of fiscal constraint. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is David Matsuda, Administrator of the U.S. Maritime Administration. Dave, given the significant fiscal and economic pressures the country is facing, DOT leadership has embarked on a department-wide cost-cutting effort. Would you tell us more about your efforts to cut costs and realize savings? What are some of the key initiatives being pursued within your agency to achieve cost reductions?
Well, one of the ways that we've looked at our programs and our budget is to say, what resources do we need right now to do the job? We try not to stockpile funds, or there may be other better uses for them in the federal government. We've identified a number of cost-saving opportunities in the way that we manage our fleet. For instance, I don't think I've talked about that yet, but we do manage for the military a large fleet of cargo ships around the country, about 48 of them currently. And we go out and hire commercial ship operators to manage the vessels, to crew them, to maintain them, and to keep them ready if the military would ever need them. These ships are usually ready within a few days, whereas if you go out to the ships that are operating commercially under the Maritime Security Program, sometimes it'll take a little while to pull those ships out of service and make them available to the military. So this is kind of a surge, a standby fleet that can be ready to assist the military upon a fairly short notice. And we've worked very closely with them to achieve cost savings. I know a few years ago, there was a decision to transfer a number of ships from the Navy over to us for commercial management. And that's resulted in a large savings, millions of dollars per year. And we're continuing to provide that. And we'll continue to look for those opportunities wherever we can.
Well, you did mention your strong environmental stewardship focus of your agency, particularly with the disposal of old vessels. What are the pressing environmental issues facing the maritime industry? And more particularly, what are you doing besides the disposal, ship disposal? What else are you doing in the area of environmental protection to reduce the impact by the industry on the environment?
Well, the ship disposal program is probably a good example of what we can do to set the example and the way that we maintain our fleets to do what's best for the environment and frankly, the right thing to do. And we know that the right thing to do is not to kind of dig in and fight with the local regulators, but actually to work with the communities and make sure that there's a good understanding of what we're doing. And we can listen to it and to new ideas as well. So we're pleased to have been able to do that. We also have a very strong core environmental program focused more on looking for innovative ways to help tackle some of the industry key challenges. For instance, one of the biggest problems vexing the industry right now is the problem of invasive aquatic species. You may have heard of the zebra mussel, the problems in the Great Lakes. There are many new modern environmental standards that are coming into place, whether it's the Coast Guard or EPA or the International Maritime Organization, setting very strict standards as to the treatment of ballast water. Now, a ship's ballast water, when you travel around the world, you're traveling from ecosystem to ecosystem, different bioregions. And so when you take on water and all of the little creepy crawly things in it in from one area of the world and bring it to another and discharge it, you can see this is how the problems like the zebra mussel takeover occur. And so the new standards require a better treatment of that ballast water to make sure there's no living organisms in there that could do damage to a place like I'll say the Great Lakes. Mm-hmm. There's so much at stake, and it's not just transportation isn't the only use of the our oceans and rivers and lakes, but frankly, it is a major part of it. So we're often finding ourselves reminding folks that there's not, you can't just stop all transportation on the water. I mean, there has to be a way to work through this, to using technology that's available, that's effective to help solve the problem. And as regulators figure out, all right, what's the appropriate level to set at, we are working to find out what's actually technologically feasible. And so we're running three different laboratories, one on the East Coast, one on the West Coast, and one in the Great Lakes, where we can test these technologies to see if they actually work. And we're making the results public so that when ship owners or operators, when they're evaluating the different technologies and trying to figure out what to buy for their ship, they don't have to just rely on marketing claims. Yeah. They can actually see what an independent analysis will show. And this also helps the regulators as they determine, what the appropriate standard will be. We'll be able to show what's actually feasible right now.
You mentioned earlier that a key strategic goal for your agency is seeking to enhance the competitiveness of U.S. transportation providers and manufacturers in the global marketplace. Would you elaborate on your multifaceted approach to improving connectivity of the U.S. marine transportation system with the global transportation system? What else needs to be done for more safer, more efficient, and cost-effective movement of goods?
Well, let me answer that a couple of ways. Number one, when we look to make U.S. companies more competitive in the world market, one of the things we do is work with our partners internationally to try and tear down market barriers and get better access for our companies who want to be more competitive or participate in these markets overseas. So we'll interface directly with counterparts from key maritime and shipping companies. I meet every year with my counterparts from China. We are working with governments from Vietnam. Last year, I had the opportunity to visit, key dignitaries in Denmark, Greece, and a lot of some of the big, shipping countries or markets. Brazil is another one I visited with the secretary last year, and we got to discuss a number of maritime issues. So we have a very robust international program. In fact, there's a group of nations that often consult together, mostly European countries that we meet with biannually as well. So there is regular healthy communication. We bring in the U.S. industry as well into these discussions where appropriate. We make sure we hear from them. We make sure we're pushing where we can and make progress where we can as well. The second part of this, I would say that to try and make maritime better connected to the U.S. transportation system probably occurs right there at the port. And ports have kind of naturally flourished in our country in ways that have let them kind of sustain themselves or survive over long periods of time. All of our major cities have kind of grown up and built around the seaports. And that's, expected. The challenge now is that if you're trying to expand a port or access to that port, usually you've got a lot of urban kind of growth right around it. And so there are competing interests when it comes to development of some of these industrial properties. People who really want to have access right next to the port for a warehouse, for instance, are competing with, the developer wants to build condos and that could probably charge a lot more money for them. So there's often that, those tough decisions that the local communities have to make. But it has an effect on the entire, supply chain. So we want to make sure we're working with ports so they can understand some of these challenges and how that we can help share some of the best practices. For the first time ever, the Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood, last year assembled all of the nation's port directors and held the first ever port summit, which we followed up again this year with. And I know we'll continue to do because it really does provide a healthy discussion for what are the current challenges that many of the ports are facing and give, access as well to some of our key decision makers when it comes to developing our nation's transportation policy. But one of the probably the biggest challenges is that because ports have never really needed, you know, they've always had their own sources of revenue. They could charge for, you know, whether it's leasing out terminal space or putting charges on goods coming into their port. They've never really needed the revenues that state departments of transportation have. So the planning process between ports and state DOTs has never been as coordinated as it should be. In fact, I've met with many state officials, and there are very few state departments of transportation that even have a maritime office or a port office or even a freight office. And so it's very difficult sometimes to, you know, try and get the focus of a state DOT to be anything, you know, other than highway focused or just looking at kind of residential pothole type issues or, you know, the needs of, you know, many of the people, whereas somebody's got a plan for the freight movements as well, because they certainly impact all of us and everybody else who uses the transportation system.
So another thing I wanted to talk to you about was developing future leaders, and it's critical for your agency. Can you talk to me a little bit about the efforts you're pursuing to succession planning and executive development?
Absolutely. And the maritime administration. One of the challenges I had when I walked in the door, we did a survey and found that very quickly I asked our senior staff to raise their hand if they're eligible to retire. Every single one of them raised their hand. We did a survey within the agency and said, you know, how many are eligible to retire in the next 5 years? Well, a third of the agency was eligible to retire in 5 years. And so that really poses a challenge when you're trying to develop some sort of a succession strategy. So with a fairly senior agency like we had, we really need to struggle to plan ahead. What that means is that we have to take a close look when somebody leaves the agency. Are we backfilling at the same grade, or are we looking to develop a less experienced person and let them grow into that role so that we have kind of a smoother transition and a longer period of which we can help grow new leaders for the agency?
Do you have any special programs that you're pursuing in particular around executive development or mentorships?
And mentoring is one that we highly encourage. I know I have a mentee as well as a mentor, several mentors, and I can't speak highly enough to those types of programs.
So actually, it's a good segue into what's your approach to empowering your employees? What are you doing to foster results-oriented performance culture within your agency?
Well, a number of things. For instance, one of the key challenges I found when I walked in the door is that the agency had always long been known for its kind of informality. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that, you know, pretty much anybody could walk into the administrator's office and say, hey, I've got an issue here, I've got a problem. We still encourage that, but we also try to develop a more formal kind of decision-making process so that at least these issues have been teed up, you know, before somebody comes to me, you know, well, all right, have you talked to the lawyers? You know, is this legal to do, or do we have the money for this? You know, did you talk to the budget people, the CFO? Those are the kinds of things that I want to make sure are done so that there's a smoother decision-making process at the agency, but also most effectively use everybody's resources and time. I found time is one of the most precious commodities as a leader that you have.
What does the future hold for the U.S. Maritime Administration? We will ask its administrator, David Matsuda, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Each edition of the Business of Government magazine has as its focus the core mission of the IBM Center, connecting research to practice as a means to improve public management. We do this by bringing together insights and perspectives blended with an equal measure of practicality and reflection from an array of government leaders, public managers, thinkers, and practitioners. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. In an era of fiscal contraction, today's leaders face unique challenges that present many difficult choices. It is a period that, while imposing many constraints, simultaneously confers as many opportunities to make a difference, introduce new ways of managing, explore pragmatic approaches, and pursue management imperatives that help government leaders perform in an ever-challenging, complex environment. In our latest edition, we bring you conversations with FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, outlining the Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen. Rafael Boris, DHS Undersecretary for Management, discusses how the department is turning its one DHS vision into a reality. Stephen Goldsmith, Deputy Mayor for Operations for the City of New York, discusses how the city is shaping a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and efficient. we offer perspectives on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century from Professor Joseph S. Nye, Jr. and General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command. Our forum presents 7 management imperatives that government leaders must pursue to be successful in this new environment. All of this and so much more in the Spring-Summer 2011 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is David Matsuda, Administrator of the U.S. Maritime Administration. Dave, I have the pleasure of talking to many of our guests about collaboration and partnerships among agencies and with the private sector to achieve mission results. How are you at the Maritime Administration leveraging partnerships to improve operations and program outcomes? And I really would like you to talk about how you deal with the stakeholders in the industry.
Well, we have so many different partners help us achieve our goals and really make our agency a success. So it is a constant challenge to make sure that we are engaging with them at every level of the agency, whether it's another federal agency or if it's an industry partner, whether it's somebody in the on the labor side or the environmental community or even in the media. Because we're a promotional agency, we have some of our biggest challenges are trying to get our message out there and try and let people know just how important this industry is. I can tell you one of the frustrations that I share with many people in the industry is that, you know, we go to a lot of events where it'll be a ceremony or some kind of recognition for the good work that gets done. You know, just there's so many great examples of it. But we keep going to the same ceremonies with the same people, and our message doesn't get out. People just don't understand what a fantastic job the maritime industry is doing and the great examples of it. So that's one of our big challenges. But working with our stakeholders, I can tell you that, you know, I've invited in to our headquarters just about every CEO from this industry, whether it's the shippers, the shipbuilders, the labor union heads, and really tried to get a conversation going with them and understand what the key needs. We have learned so much from those types of discussions that it really helps us focus and set the dial for the direction we want to go. We also work closely, I think I mentioned, with our other federal partners, not just within the building, you know, the other DOT agencies, but, you know, again, the military, Department of State, we work closely with Department of Energy now. We're, you know, all kinds of partners we have to really make our operation work and work well. Recently, the Secretary has gone forward with a new advisory committee. So now we have a formal committee we can charge, you know, tasks with and also receive formal advice from.
Well, picking up on the idea of making your agency work well, and what are you doing to ensure you have a well-trained and technical workforce to meet the challenges of today as well as the opportunities of tomorrow?
Well, the one good thing about the maritime industry is I found people are so mission-focused and dedicated that we often don't have much of a problem finding a good people to work at the maritime administration. The challenge is keeping them and growing the next generation as well. Like I said, it's getting harder and harder. It's the same challenge that we face is what everybody in the maritime industry faces, and that's how do we make this industry sexy for the next generation, because the kids that are going to school may not understand what it's like to work on a ship or have any desire to work on a ship or anywhere in this industry. It may be tough to keep even skilled jobs like welders, for instance. It is. I've talked to so many shipyard owners that say, you know, we spend so much time and money training welders, and then they can just walk off, you know, the next day after they're trained and go get a great job, you know, in another type of manufacturing industry. But welding for ships is a very specialized type of welding, and it takes that specialized training. So it is a challenge to make sure you keep people and get them excited at a very young age into the maritime industry. And again, that is one of our key challenges.
So I want to transition to the future. Would you give us a sense of the key trends that will impact the U.S. maritime transportation system over the next, say, 3 or 4 years?
Absolutely. One of the first things I did after I was confirmed as administrator, within the first 100 days, I launched a series of studies that looked at some of the key challenges that the maritime industry is going to be facing. One of them is the expansion of the Panama Canal. And what does that mean for our country, transportation system? So we're working with the Secretary of Transportation, his policy experts, in developing a study where we get a good objective look at exactly what kinds of changes our nation is either going to need or going to expect. And that kind of analysis has never been done. So it's something that will affect everybody. You know, the Panama Canal right now, the largest ship that can get through it can carry about 5,000 20-foot containers, so maybe about half that number. And it's what a standard size, you know, you see on the back of a truck. Mm-hmm. It's going to grow to about 13,000 per ship. And so that's a massive increase in the size of the ships that are going to be transiting through the canal. And what that means for the ports on the east coast of the U.S. and the Gulf Coast of the U.S. and what that impact will be on the west coast of the U.S. is something that we need to understand if we're going to plan and operate a national transportation system. You can imagine that, you know, to offload all the cargo from one of these ships and fully load it at a single port would take 13,000 truck trips. Can you imagine if you lived in a port community and had two of these a week visiting, what it would mean for your commute if you are sharing the road with these trucks, or whether there is a rail line that connects to it? Can you imagine the number of trains and the kinds of the times they'll be blocking the rail crossings on the highway? These are things that we really need to understand if we're going to take advantage of maybe some of the new efficiencies or understand where some of our infrastructure investments need to be made.
And this is a perfect example of why you need to expand the conversation and invite the state departments of transportation involved and get the folks involved.
Absolutely.
Tremendous impact if it's not done right.
And that was really the first one. We launched three other studies. One is on the future of the Great Lakes. I talked about some of the environmental challenges there with the aging vessels and how we can best tackle some of those challenges. And so we look forward to the results of that study as well. A third one, we're trying to design the next generation marine highway vessel, one that is both commercially viable in the U.S., where we can carry containers or trailers along the coasts or rivers or in our waterways. To design a ship, you need to define the market it'll be competing in. And also the challenge here is, can it be militarily useful? Because if it's militarily useful, then, you know, maybe we can have that conversation with the Navy or the U.S. military about, well, you know, if this is something useful to you guys, maybe it's worthy of federal investment. We want to make sure that we identify every opportunity for that kind of a win-win situation. The last study we started was a close look at the difference in operating costs between U.S. flagships and foreign flagships. And that was a comprehensive look at how we can best identify those so we can try and tackle them. Now, some of these cost items are pretty obvious. Our mariners in the U.S. have a higher standard of living than many others around the world. They have higher training standards, for safety, environmental, and the kinds of things that they're required to do. And therefore, the cost is a little bit higher. And so some of these challenges, though, that may not seem, on their face to be a real difference. But, for instance, other countries don't tax the income their mariners make abroad, whereas ours do. And that can make a significant difference in the competitiveness of some of our workers and in the world market. So we need to get a good handle on these things and try and propose changes wherever we can to make sure that we're remaining the most competitive.
Yeah, so stepping back from the industry trends that you foresee, what about the major opportunities and challenges your organization will encounter in the future? And how do you envision your agency evolving to meet some of these challenges and see some of the opportunities?
I will say that one of the things that I was told before coming to this agency, and one that I've tried to observe very closely, is that the Maritime Administration is just a collection of programs. It's not really a singular mission-focused type of agency. And I think, you know, many agencies probably have that similar program problem in the federal government, where it's, you know, a number of programs just kind of fighting on their own and not really leveraging each other. I've tried to focus on integrating the senior staff to try and make them work more as a team. I've also tried to make sure that the agency's mission is felt by every single employee at the agency. And that is essentially to promote and advocate for the maritime industry. And that's something I want to make sure that every person feels that it's their responsibility to do.
I'd like to know how you're promoting the next generation of merchant mariners, and more particularly, what advice would you give to someone who's thinking about a career in public service?
Oh, wow. Next generation of mariners is a tough one. We actually have programs where we work with a number of maritime high schools around the country, and these are specialized high schools that will, you know, help broaden young minds to get them thinking about what it's like to have a career in this industry. But frankly, a lot of what I've learned is that you really need to reach out to folks at a younger age. And so we're trying to do everything we can to reach that level of folks. I'm mostly in the, you know, 7th, 8th grade, kind of junior high age range, where people truly are, you know, they still do have an open mind about the types of careers available to them.
Well, I want to thank you for your time today. But more importantly, I'd like to thank you for your dedicated service to the country.
Well, thank you. Let me just add that, you know, one of the toughest parts is to try and make people aware about the value of the merchant marine and what it means. A recent video that we put together, I think, really exemplifies just how critical and how important this industry is and the people who work in it and the types of values and dedication that they possess. And it's one that you'll find on the White House blog, the president's blog, as of very recently. And it talks about the contribution of the merchant mariners in the New York, New Jersey port after and on 9/11. They helped evacuate some, you know, 500,000 people in the largest sea lift operation ever. And even Dunkirk wasn't this big in World War II. But they did it with no planning. No organization whatsoever, but they helped get all these people to safety as the World Trade Centers were falling and people were panicking. And you know, Southern Manhattan is basically an island, and so you're trying to get all these people out. And I can say that the merchant marine community performed admirably.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with David Matsuda, Administrator of the U.S. Maritime Administration within the U.S. Department of Transportation. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.
The environmental problems we're facing today are more complex than those of 40 years ago. What is EPA doing to better incorporate sustainability into its decision-making? Why is EPA involved in green chemistry research? Join host Michael Keegan on the next The Business of Government Hour as he explores those questions and so much more with Dr. Paul Anastas, Assistant Administrator, Office of Research and Development within the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.